The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're coming to you live from our studio in Edmond, Oklahoma. For me, this will be my last day here for a few months as we head back to Edstone later on today. Big travel day for the family. Thanks also to Brad McDonald for filling in yesterday from Edstone as he spoke to you about just the impact that President Obama will have or has had on the United States and how much of that Donald Trump will be able to roll back or not. If you didn't hear that program yesterday, that is available at thetrumpet.com and also at kpcg.fm. There have been quite a few articles rolling in that talk about the impact of 8 years of President Obama, and even some that have been writing about what he intends to do after he is out of office on January the 20th. I think Melanie Phillips had a piece titled The Agitator in Chief, or Will President Obama, or Will Barack Obama continue to agitate? He's planning to be fairly vocal and to certainly carry on with his agenda as best he can, even when he's out of office. And I think planning to live there in Washington, D.C. as well, which is a little bit unusual. This piece here from The Telegraph, it talks about, it's talking about the mounting obstacles that Obama's putting up in front of Donald Trump. And it mentions how early on, you recall the meeting that Trump and Obama had, where it seemed like they were making nice with each other and everything was going to be smooth. President Obama was talking about how smooth the transition would be from his administration to a Trump administration. And then since that time, he's been taking action, as it says here in The Telegraph. Then there's Obama the Caesar. I mean, first there's Obama, the one who's reaching out to Donald Trump. But then there's Obama the Caesar with an eye on his immortal reputation. This is, again, from the Daily Telegraph. It says his relations with Congress have been bad, so he relied on executive orders to get things done. And that leaves his legacy exposed, since his successor can come in and overturn them. He had a pen and a phone, and he had all of these executive orders. And so now what happens if another authoritarian comes in and says, no, we want it in the other direction? We're going to reverse what he did. That could well happen. But as Brad McDonald was saying yesterday, there's quite a few things that that this administration has accomplished that really are going to be quite difficult to roll back. And even President Obama has been out there saying that. It may sound good to voters. It may be a popular message for those in opposition to President Obama. But we'll have to see just how much success the Trump administration has in reversing some of these policies. Well, this piece here from The Telegraph, it just rolls through what's happened here just in the last few weeks. The transfer of detainees from Guantanamo, well, this probably goes back a few months. Then the commutations, reducing the sentences. I think 231 people in one day, setting a new record. The ban on oil drilling off of much of the coast of the Atlantic, around the Arctic. The recent President Obama expelled those Russian diplomats. I believe that was last year in protest, or sorry, last week. Well, I guess that would be last year in protest to the hacking during the presidential campaign election. And if you recall, I mean, it was in 2012, just 4 years ago, when President Obama, when he was campaigning against Mitt Romney, he just ridiculed the Republicans, and Romney in particular, for identifying Russia as a strategic threat. And now look at relations between the United States and Russia, as this article points out. It's as if President Obama's trying to hand over a Cold War to Donald Trump. And then you know about all of the overtures that Trump has made to Vladimir Putin. It says here, meanwhile, Obama decided to wave through a UN resolution condemning Israeli settlements. This again, happened last week or a week and a half ago. On this, the president defies sanity. He overturned decades of U.S. policy, removed any doubt in Palestinian minds that they have a right to demand Israeli land, and left many Israeli citizens in a legal no man's land. This was, and we stress this repeatedly, I mean, this was a massive shift in U.S. policy, and it happened just a week and a half ago at the U.N. I thought it was interesting. One of you listeners sent me this short piece by Ben Shapiro talking about this UN resolution and how it's going to lead to Jewish deaths. It endangers the little state of Israel. And all of this, as he noted in his piece, all of this pleases Obama. It pleases President Obama because he's had this anti-Israel stance from the very beginning. And then Shapiro ends with this, and some of you, I think, will raise an eyebrow over this for sure. It says, Israel will survive this as they have survived far worse challenges, and they won't be thrown from the temple by a foreign power the day before Hanukkah, a holiday that celebrates the reestablishment of a Jewish-controlled Jerusalem. The Maccabees are alive and well, Shapiro says, and they're ruling themselves no matter what the would-be United Nations Antiochuses have to say about it. That's Shapiro writing about the Antiochuses working together with the United Nations. And, of course, in our America Under Attack book, he's of course, referring back to the actual history with the Antiochus, the first Antiochus and the Maccabees, that history before Jesus Christ, a century or two before Christ. But we've had a lot to say about it with respect to prophecy, what the book of Daniel prophesies. And you can read more about that in America Under Attack. In any event, back to this Telegraph piece. It says here, to brand, this is the last paragraph, to brand Trump a divisive candidate ignores that America was a very divided place before he came along. You know, you can sit there as a critic of Trump and say that, well, he's going to divide America. But look at America today. I mean, look at America right now. As Brad McDonald said yesterday on this show, I mean, you have more Americans that are certain that the racial divide in America is far worse today than it was 8 years ago. It says Trump and Obama are stylistically opposite, but they share a view of the presidency as a tool to get things done, a blunt instrument used in the most careless and imperious manner. It says neither man is seriously interested in bringing the country together. Their loyalty is to their coalition alone. And anyone who doesn't like them isn't worth talking to. They're not even worth talking to. You may have seen that tweet by Donald Trump a few days ago, where he was lashing out at his enemies. And that's what President Obama has done. Neither men really are serious about bringing the country together. And stylistically, they're opposites, as this Telegraph piece brings out. But they're both authoritarians for sure. They're both taking action to satisfy their coalition. Their coalition alone. It's going to be an interesting next few weeks, an interesting next few years. So much Bible prophecy is being fulfilled. this piece here, we've made some of these same points, but it's put together in an effective way at Project Syndicate by Noriel Rubini. He's the one who correctly predicted the 2008 financial crisis. And so people have been taking note of what he predicts or what he has to say because he got it right back in 2008. It says here, Donald Trump's election as president of the United States does not just represent a mounting populist backlash against globalization. It may also portend the end of Pax Americana, the international order of free exchange and shared security that the U.S. and its allies built after World War II. It goes on and talks about these past 70 years of prosperity and how so much of it was built up on these foundations of free trade and America serving as the global policeman. And then as he brings out in his piece, as I say, this is something we've talked about on the show. These protectionist policies of Donald Trump, anti-globalization, and what this will lead to. He says, when the U.S. pursued similar policies in the 1920s and 30s, it helped sow the seeds of World War II. Protectionism, starting with the Smoot-Hawley Tariff, which affected thousands of imported goods, triggered retaliatory trade and currency wars that worsened the Great Depression. That's the thing. Just like Ronald Reagan noted back in the mid-1980s. It sounds good. We need trade barriers. We need to slap tariffs on those imports. But how will other nations respond? How will they retaliate? He goes on and says here, this is Noriel Rubini. He talks, too, about American isolationism. He says, based on a false belief that the U.S. was safely... He's hearkening back to this period leading up to World War II. Based on a false belief that the U.S. was safely protected by two oceans, it allowed Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan to wage aggressive war and threaten the entire world. With the attack on Pearl Harbor in December 1941, the U.S. was finally forced to take its head out of the sand. It was forced to act. But leading up to that, of course, there were many people, even the leaders of the United States, that were saying, look, we've got to protect American companies. And we're not going to be bothered about what's happening abroad because we're protected. We've got these massive barriers, two oceans, to protect us. It says here, as in the 1930s, when protectionist and isolationist U.S. policies hampered global economic growth and trade and created the conditions for rising revisionist powers to start a world war, similar policy impulses could set the stage for new powers to challenge and undermine the American-led international order. In other words, we're seeing the very same patterns today. We see history repeating itself. He concludes here, the historical record is clear. Protectionism, isolationism, and America First policies are a recipe for economic and military disaster. That's just been the history. It's a recipe for disaster. That's what's happening in the United States, or what it looks like with a new administration coming in. And meanwhile, in Europe, in Germany in particular, you have another administration that may be on the way out. Angela Merkel, as the Spiegel says here, the year of destiny. She's facing her toughest challenge this year, 2017. It's her toughest test. And she knew even before that attack on December 19th that attack on the Christmas market, she knew it was going to be difficult. Now, as this article brings out, it's an uphill battle, all the more so. It says in the past months, the struggle for the right course in the refugee policy and the hostility from the right wing were only foretastes for what lies ahead of Merkel. It says, of course, the chancellor knows she can no longer win the Merkel must go callers back, but even beyond the AfD clientele, there are many who personally see the government as accountable for Germany being haunted by terror. There's a lot of Germans who believe it's her fault. It's her fault. And this attacker from December 19th, I mean, he was killed in Italy, but he came into Europe basically because of Merkel's welcome policy, because of Merkel's open arms policy. Spiegel says here, if Germany had been spared from a severe Islamic attack, Merkel might have been able to make it to the election without having to make too many concessions to her critics. Even the permanent dispute with the CSU was seemingly moving towards reconciliation. But it says here, the attack on the Berlin Christmas market, however, puts Merkel under pressure. It puts Merkel under pressure. Driven by the AfD, CSU boss Horst Seehofer has been calling for a realignment of the refugee and security policy. And that leads us into this other piece here. I think a very important one from Foreign Policy. Richard Palmer sent me this one this morning that says Merkel should beware the Bavarians, not the populace. And we've had a lot to say about the populist movements because it certainly does show the direction that Germany's headed in. The rise of these far-right parties. The AfD, I mean, there was the report yesterday, you may have heard about it, where Hitler's Mein Kampf was one of the more popular bestsellers last year. 85,000 copies of that book. And then the people distributing that book saying or defending the fact that, well, this is great for scholarship. 85,000 copies of Mein Kampf? I mean, that was Adolf Hitler's manifesto, of all things. That was Adolf Hitler calling for Germany to annex neighboring countries, to give Germany more space, to persecute the Jews. It led to the Holocaust. And, well, that work is just one of the more popular reads in Germany today. I mean, that is significant. The rise of these far-right parties, that is significant. But as this piece says in Foreign Policy, what we really need to be watching for is what's going on in Bavaria and what about this split between Merkel's CDU party and then the Bavarian CSU party. The CSU party is, as you might know, that's Karl Theodor zu Gutenberg's party. What about this division? Foreignpolicy.com says it's a testament to the strange contours of Germany's political landscape that while the physical effects of the December 19 attack on the Berlin Christmas market have been based in the German capital, that's Berlin, the center of the political fallout has been located some 360 miles southward. That's Bavaria. It's too early to know whether the vicious attack committed by a Tunisian asylum seeker will change the trajectory of Germany's anti-immigrant far-right movements, but the attack's aftermath has already produced a consequential divide between northern Germany and the south, whose respective political elites have been engaged in a rivalry that long predates the present migration crisis. It long predates what we're seeing happen today. It predates what happened in the 1930s and 40s. It says here, anyone who wants to understand the political fights that loom in Germany's immediate future should probably spend less time studying the populist Alternative for Germany party than the entrenched political establishment of the southern German state of Bavaria, familiar to foreigners as the home of Oktoberfest and Lederhosen, and the idiosyncratic culture that sustains its heightening feud with Chancellor Angela Merkel. Well, it goes on and talks about this feud that really has intensified because of the refugee crisis. You've read, we've reported on this program, some of the strong comments coming from Horst Seehofer, the CSU boss. It says here in foreignpolicy.com, the CSU-CDU standoff, however, is not merely the product of disagreements over immigration policy or sharp divergences in personality between the leading contenders. It's the latest manifestation in a two-century-old battle over leadership of the German region between North and South, or more specifically, between Prussian Berlin and Bavarian Munich. And then this article goes on and gives some important history, dating back to the days of Napoleon and carrying right on through Bismarck and World War One, and then, of course, the Second World War. But it says here, Germany's unification papered over, but did not diminish. This is talking about when the wall came down in 1989 and Germany, East and West Germany, was reunited. It says that this unification papered over, but it did not diminish the socio-political and cultural divide between the largely Protestant North and the heavily Catholic South. The Bavarian region is heavily Catholic. It's dominated by Catholicism. And so who do you suppose is going to win out? This, again, this is the divide we need to keep our eyes on. It says here further, it was in malcontented Munich that the Nazi Party was born in 1919. Here again, this is just recent history. Talks about the beer hall pooch. I mean, it was a failed endeavor in 1923. But then Hitler came to power 10 years later. Foreignpolicy.com says it was thus all the more frustrating for Bavarians that none of their leaders, even the imposing Franz Josef Strauss, ever managed to claim the top spot in Bonn. And so since that time, the end of World War II, it was first Bonn and then Berlin that dominated the northern cities. But now we're seeing the rise of Bavaria, the rise of Catholic-dominated Bavaria, the rise of the CSU party. It says German reunification in 1990 and the Bundestag's subsequent decision to move the capital back to Berlin seemed to swing the pendulum of power once again from south to north. For years, Munich has been poised to call the shots in Berlin to provide guidance in a time of manifold challenges and crises. And it has aimed to do just that during its 11-year coalition with Merkel, who depends on the CSU to maintain power. So she's had this coalition with the CSU, and she needs it. She needs it to stay in power. And so it's significant when you see Seehofer and others coming out with such strong condemnation for these refugee policies and other things. It says here, finally, that has become especially evident amid the immigration crisis that reached its peak in 2015, when Merkel suddenly threw open Germany's borders. Well, to all the refugees, you know the history here, the recent history. It says, but Bavarian Premier Seehofer soon sounded the loudest voice in a chorus of complaint from German regional leaders. Bavaria hadn't been consulted, he protested, and Berlin was producing little support beyond Merkel's nice words of welcome. I mean, most of these refugees were streaming through the south, or Bavaria. And as Seehofer pointed out, I mean, Bavaria hadn't been consulted. What about us? Well, again, it goes through just what's happened more recently with the terrorist attacks from over the past year, even in Bavaria. And then most recently, the attack on December 19th in Berlin. Finally, it says here, the stakes of this rivalry are quite high. The battle is not just over the soul of the Union, as one commentator suggested, but over Merkel's ability to retain control in Berlin, and more broadly, over the nature of the German body politic as it enters a crucial election year full of urgent challenges from within and without. We're in the midst now, it's 2017, a crucial election year, and there's lots for us to keep our eyes on. As you know, the prophecy in Daniel 8, well, also Daniel 11, talking about this end time Antiochus to emerge out of the heart of Europe. He's going to come in through deceitful lies and flatteries. That's the way he'll come to power. That's in Daniel 11 and verse 21. And so it's going to be critically important for us to watch this battle between the CDU and the CSU, this battle between the Protestant-dominated North and the Catholic-dominated South, or Bavaria. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
A turning point in recent history has gone almost entirely overlooked. Since that time, an unseen cause has brought about national and world troubles in unprecedented fashion. Crises are intensifying as never before. In our generation, we are seeing radical changes to culture, family, education, religion, science, finance, politics, international relations. Everything has been affected. You cannot understand events without recognizing this unseen cause. The United States has been shaken in astonishing fashion. Have you wondered why the world's number one superpower is declining so rapidly? Are you concerned about where the current administration is leading this country? The Bible provides penetrating insight into the invisible cause of society's decline. America is prophesied to fall before it rises again. The Bible also gives extraordinary insight into how that fall will come about. This insight puts the seriousness and urgency of current events in their true perspective. Understand what's in store for America and why. Visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request this free, enlightening booklet, America Under Attack.
The Trumpet Daily.
I was recently going through a study of those last two or three chapters in the book of James. My father, of course, has a powerful booklet on the subject of James' epistles, or James's epistle, I should say. But right in the middle of chapter 5, there are four instances where James uses the word behold. And as my father explains in his booklet, if you look at what he's stressing there, that word behold means to look or to perceive. It's as if James was saying to brethren that were falling away from the truth, look, you know, take note of what's happening. Pay attention. See what's going on right before your eyes. Open your eyes. In James 5, in verse 7, it says, be patient, therefore, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord. It says, behold, or look, or perceive, behold, the husband waits for the precious fruit of the earth, and has long patience for it until he receives the early and latter rain. Be patient unto the coming of the Lord. James is saying, open your eyes and look. And then there's three or four references to the return of Jesus Christ. So many of God's people in these latter days, they've grown weary in well-doing. And they've stopped looking. They've stopped beholding. They're blind spiritually, as it says in Revelation 3. James continues here in verse 8. This is James 5:8. It says, But be you also patient, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord draws near. Over and again here, he's emphasizing the imminence of Jesus Christ's second coming. It's mentioned, I think, four times in seven verses. Christ's return is near. It's right at the door. Make sure you establish your heart. Establish your heart in this truth, in this foundation, while there's still time. Verse 9 says, grudge not one against another, brethren, lest you be condemned. Behold, the judge stands before the door. Here again, Jesus Christ, the righteous judge, he's right there standing at the door. And he's ready to rush in, if we'll let him in. Verse 10 says, take, my brethren, the prophets who have spoken in the name of the Eternal for an example of suffering affliction and of patience. Look at these examples. Look at these faithful heroes in Hebrews 11, for example. All of those tremendous examples of faith. The patience of those men and women. Suffering affliction, some of them. Many of them. Enduring through trial and test. Verse 11 says, behold, we count them happy which endure. You have heard of the patience of Job, and have seen the end of the Eternal, that the Lord is pitiful and of tender mercy. Job, of course, had to endure some very painful trials to learn some profound lessons. Remember the patience of Job, God says. In other words, we have to endure. We have to endure through to the end. That's what it says in Matthew 24 and verse 13. He that endures to the end, the same shall be saved. A lot of people have gotten discouraged. A lot of God's people have gotten discouraged and given up in this race that we're in. And God says, behold, take note of the fact that Christ's return is almost here. Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong, he wrote back in a coworker letter from 1967. He said, what would you think of a man in a mile race who was running so well, he was just about to win the race and set a new world record, and then halfway through the gun lap, he just quit running and sat down to rest and said, ho-hum. Mr. Armstrong, by the way, he often used this analogy, this gun lap analogy. He said, how much more should we apply this exhortation today in this end of the end time work? What God needs from all members and co-workers of Christ is that final burst of energy down the home stretch. We must give this great work a mighty additional push. The time is short, and it's vital. It's the most important thing in our lives right now, God's work. It's the most important thing in our lives. This is when we have to be sprinting to the finish line. And yet so many of God's people have stopped running. They're sitting down and resting. Or in some cases, they've left the stadium altogether. Paul says over in Galatians 6, verse 7, he said, be not deceived, God is not mocked, for whatsoever a man sows, that shall he also reap. For he that sows to his flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption, but he that sows to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap everlasting life. And then he says in verse 9, let us not be weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap if we faint not. Don't be weary in well-doing, God says, or don't faint. Right at this time when we should be sprinting, don't be discouraged. Don't give up. Don't cave in to satanic pressure. Stand firm. Continue in this race. I give a lecture every other year in Epistles of Paul, showing how Paul also used the analogy of racing, sprinting, running, finishing. You can read about that in 1 Corinthians 9. And there's plenty of other sports analogies that he uses to make that same point, that we've got to endure to the end. We've got to finish what we start. I mean, what good is a strong start if we don't finish the race? Let me just conclude over here in Hebrews chapter 12. What good is a strong start if we're not in this to win it, to run after the prize, as Paul said? There's only the one prize, so run that you might obtain it. He said in Philippians 3, I press forward toward the prize of our high calling. That was the Apostle Paul's approach. Never wavered away from that. He served God all the way to the end, all the way to the point of his execution. And even there, he said, I've fought a good fight. He used another sports analogy there. I've fought a good fight, and my crown is waiting. What a reward God has for us. God is offering us everything. Hebrews 12 here, it says, wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run. Let us run with patience the race that is set before us. It's a race. Again, look at 1 Corinthians 9 on your own time. It's easy to get entangled in the affairs of this world and to slow down and to stop running. What would you think of a man in a mile race who was running so well he was just about to set a world record? And then, even in the midst of the gun lap, right down the home stretch, he decided to pull out of the race. He said, that's enough. I've had enough. I'm done. I'm finished. I'm tired. Well, spiritually, a lot of people have done that. Verse 2 says, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. Looking to Jesus Christ, he's our pace setter. We follow his steps, 1 Peter 2. We follow Christ's steps. We have to look to him. We have to follow him. He'll lead us right into the kingdom of God. Jesus Christ is in this to finish what he started. He's the author and the finisher of our faith. We've got to be a finisher. We have to complete this. I mean, what good is any of it if we don't endure? If we don't finish what we started? That's a strong point that my father makes in the James booklet. There he's emphasizing in James 5 the imminence of Christ's return. And he points out in the booklet, and James makes this point in the fifth chapter, that if we don't endure to the end, we don't receive the reward. We have to endure. We have to endure. And James says, behold, Christ's return. I mean, it's almost here. It's just around the corner. And so keep running. Keep running in this race for eternal life. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show as we put the finishing touches on a little bit of a shorter program today. So it will allow for me to have a little bit more time to do some packing this morning before we head back to Edstone. I'll be with you again from Edstone on Friday's program. Tomorrow, Richard Palmer from Edstone will be sitting in. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you again tomorrow.